This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of general and regional anesthesia in orthopedics from the basic science section on orthobullets.com. In this episode, we'll talk about the different components of anesthesia, talk about general anesthesia, local anesthesia to the upper extremity, spinal anesthesia, local anesthesia to the lower extremity, blood management, and complications related to general and regional anesthesia in orthopedics. So starting with the components of anesthesia, remember the five A's: amnesia, anxiolysis, analgesia, akinesia, and attenuation of the autonomic responses to noxious stimuli. Moving on to general anesthesia, this is essentially a pharmacologically induced coma that is characterized by a reversible loss of consciousness, irrespective of airway management. The two forms of general anesthesia that we'll discuss include inhalational anesthesia and intravenous anesthesia. Inhalational anesthesia is carried out by volatile liquids vaporized in a carrier gas, including isoflurane, sevoflurane, desflurane, and nitrous oxide. Keep in mind that nitrous oxide is associated with increased gaseous abdominal distension and leads to increased difficulty with fluoroscopic identification during pelvic and spinal procedures. Intravenous anesthesia can be divided into non-opioid, opioid, and neuromuscular blocking agents. Non-opioids include propofol, etomidate, benzodiazepines, dexmedetomidine, and ketamine. Opioids include fentanyl, alfentanyl, sufentanyl, remifentanyl, morphine, and hydromorphone. Neuromuscular blocking agents can be further divided into depolarizing agents and non-depolarizing agents. Depolarizing agents bind to, depolarize, and transiently block the acetylcholine receptor. An example of a short-acting depolarizing agent is succinylcholine, and keep in mind that there are no intermediate or long-acting depolarizing agents. Non-depolarizing agents bind to and transiently block the acetylcholine receptor, but do not depolarize. Remember that there are no short-acting agents. Examples of intermediate-acting non-depolarizing agents include rocuronium, vecuronium, atricurium, cisatricurium, and an example of a long-acting non-depolarizing agent is pancuronium. Moving on to local anesthesia for the upper extremity, examples include an interscalene regional block, a supraclavicular block, an infraclavicular block, an axillary block, and a Beer block. We'll go into the indications for each of these blocks now. Intrascalene regional blocks are commonly used for shoulder, upper arm, and elbow surgery. It's performed by injecting local anesthetic to the nerves of the brachial plexus as it passes through the groove between the anterior and middle scalene muscles at the level of the cricoid cartilage. Sensory neuropathy is the most common complication. Moving on to supraclavicular blocks, these are ideal for operations involving the arm and forearm from the lower humerus down to the hand. This block basically targets the brachial plexus superior to the clavicle. Complications can include nerve injury and intravascular injection, pneumothorax, dyspnea, and damage to the subclavian artery. An infraclavicular block is also ideal for operations involving the arm and the forearm, from the lower humerus down to the hand, and these blocks target the brachial plexus inferior to the clavicle. Axillary blocks are usually done for postoperative analgesia for surgery to the elbow, forearm, wrist, and the hand. Finally, a Beer block is indicated for short operative procedures that are less than 60 minutes long in the hand and the forearm, like carpal tunnel releases. The procedure for a Beer block is typically S-mark exsanguination and tourniquet inflation, injecting lidocaine through a small distal hand intravenous catheter on the surgical side, and making sure to deflate the tourniquet after a minimum of 30 minutes to avoid venous release of local anesthetic and potential local anesthetic systemic toxicity, otherwise known as LAST. Moving on to spinal anesthesia, this is often used for knee and hip arthroplasty. A single injection is given with a small 24 or 27 gauge needle, and a combination of morphine as well as bupivacaine is often used. Complications of spinal anesthesia include spinal headache, which is decreased when a small gauge needle is used. Other complications of spinal anesthesia include hematoma and opioid side effects like nausea, vomiting, pruritus, and/or respiratory depression. Epidural anesthesia is also often used for knee and hip arthroplasty. It's similar to spinal anesthesia, except an indwelling catheter is placed, and a combination of opioid and local anesthetic is used. Complications of epidural anesthesia are the same as those seen in spinal anesthesia and also includes postoperative hypotension as well as motor impairment. A combined spinal epidural may also be used for knee and hip arthroplasty. The technique involves an epidural needle being placed into the epidural space, and spinal anesthesia is administered through a spinal needle, followed by placing an epidural catheter. Complications are the same as those seen in epidural anesthesia. Moving on to local anesthesia for the lower extremity, examples include a lumbar plexus/psoas compartment nerve block, femoral nerve block, sciatic nerve block, obturator nerve block, popliteal nerve block, and a saphenous nerve block. And we'll go into the indications, techniques, and complications for each of these nerve blocks now. A lumbar plexus/psoas compartment nerve block is indicated for surgeries involving the hip, anterior thigh, and knee. A sciatic block can be given concomitantly to provide pain relief to the entire lower extremity. A lumbar plexus/psoas compartment nerve block targets the lumbar plexus, that is, the L1 to L4 spinal nerves, which forms the obturator nerve, lateral femoral cutaneous nerve, and femoral nerve. The injection is usually placed 3 to 5 centimeters lateral to the spinous process of L4 and is often guided by ultrasound and nerve stimulators. Complications of this nerve block include nerve damage, intravascular injection, epidural diffusion, retroperitoneal hematoma, intrathecal injections, and an increased risk of falls. A femoral nerve block is indicated for surgeries around the knee. Concomitant sciatic nerve blocks can be done to increase analgesia around the knee. The intent of the block is to target the femoral nerve. The injection occurs just lateral to the femoral artery and on a line connecting the anterior superior iliac spine to the pubic symphysis. Complications are similar to those seen in lumbar plexus blocks and include nerve damage, intravascular injection, increased risk of falls, as well as prolonged quadriceps weakness and infections. Moving on to sciatic nerve blocks, these are indicated for surgeries involving the leg, ankle, and foot. They can be combined with femoral or lumbar plexus blocks to provide analgesia to the entire lower extremity. These blocks target the sciatic nerve, providing analgesia to the common peroneal and tibial nerves. Multiple techniques have been described for sciatic nerve blocks. One method is drawing lines between the greater trochanter and the posterior superior iliac spine, or PSIS, as well as the greater trochanter and the sacral hiatus. Another technique that has been described for a sciatic nerve block is halfway between the greater trochanter and the PSIS, a perpendicular line is drawn, and the injection is placed where the perpendicular line crosses the line between the greater trochanter and the sacral hiatus. Complications of sciatic nerve blocks include nerve damage, intravascular injection, vascular injury, heel ulcers, and a delay in diagnosis of nerve injuries after surgery. Moving on to an obturator nerve block, these are indicated for adductor muscle spasm, severe hip pain from osteoarthritis, and adjuvant pain management for knee surgeries. These blocks target the anterior and posterior branch of the obturator nerve. Blocking the anterior branch leads to decreased sensation at the hip joint and inner thigh, while blocking the posterior branch decreases sensation around the knee. The injection site is usually 2 centimeters inferior and 2 centimeters lateral to the pubic tubercle. Complications include nerve injury, intravascular injection, as well as damage to the structures in the pelvic cavity. Moving on to a popliteal nerve block, this is indicated for surgery around the foot and ankle. It's often used in conjunction with the saphenous nerve block. These blocks target the sciatic nerve prior to its bifurcation, and the injection site is often 10 centimeters proximal to the popliteal crease. Complications include nerve injury, intravascular injection, hematoma, persistent foot drop, and pressure sores. Finally, a saphenous nerve block is indicated for procedures around the medial aspect of the knee, leg, and ankle. These blocks target the saphenous nerve, obviously, and there are multiple different techniques. However, it's often blocked behind the sartorius muscle. Complications include nerve injury, intravascular injection, hematoma, and infection. Now, let's talk about blood management. The big concept to discuss with respect to blood management is ways to reduce post-op anemia and the need for allogenic transfusion. These methods include specific surgical factors and the use of hypotensive epidural anesthesia. And now we'll break down each of these methods in more detail. Specific surgical factors include hemostasis and meticulous dissection. Hypotensive epidural anesthesia creates an epidural block up to T2 to block cardio-acceleratory fibers of the thoracic sympathetic chain and allow intraoperative mean arterial pressure, or a MAP, of 50 millimeters of mercury. Resultant bradycardia and excessive hypotension is treated with low-dose intravenous epinephrine. By blocking cardio-acceleratory fibers of the thoracic sympathetic chain, hypotensive epidural anesthesia keeps normal heart rate, CVP, stroke volume, cardiac output, and can be used in high-risk patients with hypertension, poor cardiac function, and chronic kidney disease. Now, let's end this review session talking about some complications related to general and regional anesthesia in orthopedics. These include malignant hyperthermia, local anesthetic systemic toxicity, or LAST, and bone cement implantation syndrome. So starting with malignant hyperthermia, this is a rare, life-threatening condition seen anywhere from 1 in 15,000 to 1 in 50,000 patients. It has an autosomal dominant transmission, and studies have pointed to abnormalities in the ryanodine receptor, or RYR1 gene. Triggers of malignant hyperthermia include volatile inhalational anesthetic agents and succinylcholine, which, remember, is a depolarizing neuromuscular blocker. Symptoms of malignant hyperthermia include rapid oxygen depletion and a hypercatabolic state with increased skeletal muscle contraction and metabolism that presents with things like rigidity and/or masseter spasm. Malignant hyperthermia may also be associated with increased carbon dioxide concentration and body temperature, and it can lead to circulatory collapse and death if untreated. Treatment is providing active cooling and the antidote, which is a calcium blocker known as dantrolene, which inhibits halothane-induced and calcium-induced calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Another anesthesia complication to know is local anesthetic systemic toxicity, or LAST. Bupivacaine is a long-acting local anesthetic, and it acts on intracellular voltage-gated sodium channels to block sodium influx into nerve cells, which prevents depolarization. If administered systemically, bupivacaine can cause serious complications to the central nervous system by causing seizures, coma, and a respiratory arrest. It can also have cardiovascular effects by causing asystole, ventricular fibrillation, hypotension, arrhythmia, bradycardia, heart block, and cardiac arrest. Treatment should involve urgent administration of intravenous 20% lipid emulsion alongside standard ACLS protocols. Finally, one last complication to discuss is bone cement implantation syndrome, which is associated with the use of bone cement during joint arthroplasty procedures. Symptoms can include hypotension and hypoxemia, and the treatment consists of intravenous fluids, vasopressors, and 100% inspired oxygen. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. A 60-year-old man undergoes bilateral total hip arthroplasty under a single anesthetic. Which intervention will best reduce postoperative anemia and the need for allogenic blood transfusion? And the choices are 1. Normotensive epidural anesthesia, 2. Spinal anesthesia, 3. Hypotensive epidural anesthesia, 4. Hypotensive total intravenous anesthesia, and 5. General anesthesia. The correct answer to this question is 3, hypotensive epidural anesthesia. So in this patient, hypotensive epidural anesthesia will best reduce postoperative anemia and the need for transfusion. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, normotensive epidural anesthesia is incorrect, as hypotension, which is defined as a reduced MAP of 50 millimeters of mercury, is necessary to reduce intraoperative bleeding. Answer 2, spinal anesthesia is incorrect, as hypotensive epidural anesthesia results in reduced blood loss because of hypotension and postoperative transfusion compared with spinal anesthesia. Answer 4, hypotensive total intravenous anesthesia is incorrect, as although hypotensive total intravenous anesthesia produces similar MAP levels compared with hypotensive epidural anesthesia, hypotensive epidural anesthesia results in less intraoperative blood loss. It is hypothesized that this is because hypotensive epidural anesthesia is associated with non-positive pressure ventilation, unlike hypotensive total intravenous anesthesia, better distribution of blood flow, and lower mean intraoperative central venous pressure. Finally, answer 5, general anesthesia is incorrect, as unlike general anesthesia, regional anesthesia, including epidural and spinal anesthesia, results in lower arterial blood pressure, lower central venous pressure, and lower peripheral venous blood pressure, resulting in lower blood loss. To quickly review, in this patient, hypotensive epidural anesthesia will best reduce postoperative anemia and the need for transfusion. Hypotensive epidural anesthesia creates an epidural block up to T2 to block cardioacceleratory fibers of the thoracic sympathetic chain and allow intraoperative mean arterial pressure, or a MAP, of 50 millimeters of mercury. Resultant bradycardia and excessive hypotension is treated with low-dose intravenous epinephrine. Other measures to lower the transfusion trigger include preoperative erythropoietin, preoperative autologous blood donation, and postoperative cell saving. preoperative autologous blood donation can be used with acute normal volemic hemodilution, where 2 to 3 units of blood is exchanged for crystalloid/colloid during surgery and retransfused back after surgery. Moonen et al. Reviewed perioperative blood management. For erythropoietin, they state that 600 international units per kilogram weekly starting 3 weeks prior or 300 international units per kilogram daily for 14 days prior. They also recommend COX-2 inhibitors to avoid the COX-1-mediated antiplatelet effects of NSAIDs. Morris et al. Compared bipolar versus standard monopolar electrocautery in anterior total hip arthroplasty. They found similar transfusion rates and postoperative drop in hemoglobin between groups, although the bipolar group had an average of 12.5 cc's more blood loss, that is 140 cc's versus 127.5 cc's, with a p-value of 0.03. They concluded that the utilization of hypotensive anesthesia explained the low blood loss. They discontinued routine use of bipolar cautery with anterior total hip arthroplasty. Moving on to the next question. A 55-year-old man undergoes surgery on his right shoulder. In the preoperative holding area, he reveals that his older brother and mother have had serious problems with general anesthesia in the past. 20 minutes into the surgery, the surgeon notices skin modeling and increasing limb stiffness, making it hard to manipulate the arm. He calls for muscle relaxation, but is told a depolarizing neuromuscular blocker has already been given. End-tidal CO2 rises significantly, his pulse rate is now 120 to 130 beats per minute, and his urine appears dark. In response, the anesthesiologist disconnects the vaporizer, begins hyperventilation with oxygen, and stops all triggering agents. In addition to these steps, which of the following medications should be administered as an antidote? And the choices are 1. Naloxone, 2. Dantrolene, 3. Flumazenil, 4. Protamine, and 5. Neostigmine. The correct answer to this question is 2. Dantrolene. So dantrolene is the antidote for malignant hyperthermia. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, naloxone, is incorrect, as naloxone is an opioid antagonist and is used as the antidote for acute opioid overdose and in reducing the respiratory or mental depression due to opioids. Answer 3, flumazenil, is incorrect, as flumazenil is a GABA receptor antagonist used as an antidote in the treatment of benzodiazepine overdose. It acts by competitive inhibition at the benzodiazepine binding site on the GABA receptor. Answer 4, protamine, is incorrect, as protamine sulfate is used as the antidote for heparin overdose. Finally, answer 5, neostigmine, is incorrect, as neostigmine is used to reverse the effects of non-depolarizing muscle relaxants such as rocuronium and vecuronium at the end of an operation. It acts by preventing breakdown of acetylcholine, thus indirectly stimulating nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. To quickly review, malignant hyperthermia is rare, occurring in 1 in 15,000 to 1 in 50,000. It's a life-threatening condition triggered by volatile anesthetic agents and succinylcholine, which is a depolarizing neuromuscular blocker. It is an autosomal dominant condition caused by abnormalities in the ryanodine receptor, or RYR1 gene. It causes a hypercatabolic state with increased skeletal muscle metabolism, rapid oxygen depletion, increased carbon dioxide concentration, and increased body temperature, leading to circulatory collapse and death. Glahn et al. Described the European Malignant Hyperthermia Group guidelines for managing malignant hyperthermia. They state that malignant hyperthermia is rarer now because of increasing use of total intravenous anesthesia in European countries. McLennan et al. Described the mechanism of malignant hyperthermia. In malignant hyperthermia, the abnormal calcium release channel is more sensitive to stimulators of opening, releases more calcium, and does not close readily, flooding the cell with calcium and overpowering the calcium pump. They also found that dantrolene inhibits halothane-induced and calcium-induced calcium release from sarcoplasmic reticulum. And moving on to the final question. A 58-year-old patient suddenly develops cardiac arrest while undergoing a routine total knee arthroplasty. He is resuscitated with 20% lipid emulsion. What is the most likely causative agent for the cardiac arrest? And the choices are 1. Epinephrine, 2. Bisoprolol, 3. Bupivacaine, 4. Fentanyl, and 5. Rocuronium. The correct answer to this question is 3. Bupivacaine. So this patient's cardiac arrest was likely caused by an intravascular bolus of bupivacaine. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, epinephrine is incorrect, as intravascular epinephrine would cause hypertension and tachycardia. There's no specific antidote for epinephrine intoxication, and treatment is primarily supportive. Answer 2, bisoprolol is incorrect, as intravascular overdose of bisoprolol would cause hypotension, bradycardia, and possible cardiac arrest. Treatment includes treating bradycardia with atropine, isoproterenol, or cardiac pacing. Hypotension should be treated with IV fluids. Continuous monitoring is required. Answer 4, fentanyl is incorrect, as high doses of fentanyl usually have little significance intraoperatively under the care of the anesthesiologist. The most significant is respiratory depression. Pure opioid antagonists such as naloxone are specific antidotes if required. Finally, answer 5, rocuronium is incorrect, as high doses of rocuronium will cause respiratory depression, tachycardia, and hypertension. Sugammadex, or the trade name Bridion, is an agent for reversal of neuromuscular blockade by the agent rocuronium in general anesthesia. To quickly review, bupivacaine is a long-acting local anesthetic. It acts on intracellular voltage-gated sodium channels to block sodium influx into nerve cells, which prevents depolarization. If administered systemically, bupivacaine can cause serious complications to the cardiovascular system. Side effects include hypotension, arrhythmia, bradycardia, heart block, and cardiac arrest. Treatment should involve urgent administration of intravascular lipid emulsion alongside standard ACLS protocols. Rosenblatt et al. Described the successful use of a 20% lipid emulsion to resuscitate a patient after a presumed bupivacaine-related cardiac arrest. Resuscitation involved a lipid emulsion bolus of 1 milliliter per kilogram given immediately, which was followed by a continuous infusion until the patient stabilized. Corman et al. Evaluated the use of lipid emulsion for reversal of local anesthetic-induced toxicity. They suggest that lipid emulsion may reverse local anesthetic toxicity by extracting lipophilic local anesthetics from aqueous plasma or tissues, or by counteracting local anesthetic inhibition of myocardial fatty acid oxygenation. That's all for this review about general and regional anesthesia in orthopedics. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.